Blog Talk Radio.
Question. I often think this is one of the most amazing journeys and discussions that I've ever encountered. I know there are others, but for me and for many of us, this is a capture. It's like something revealed that was unexpected in a way. It brings us to an understanding with all its, as we say, vicissitudes, understanding and a look at history in order to help us. We have an interesting commentary today, and I think you'll like the show. So sit back, fill up your mug with whatever is in front of you, and join us. A little bit of a shout out here. Our listeners from South Austria, China, Cameroon, Canada, the Philippines, and the United States. A shout out. And welcome, and thank you for supporting us so faithfully. But begin, I'm going to get into today. We're going to start with the a bit more information about the poet that I've selected for this this show. I think you'll certainly like the music. You know, we have Bud Powell and John Ponte and Dizzy Gillespie, if you can imagine. Anyway, the poet for this program is one that may be familiar to many of you, especially if you're a scholar of you're a student of Irish poetry. This is, of course, Oscar Fingal O'Flaherty Wills Wilde. Oscar Wilde. He was born on the 16th of October in 1854. And he passed away. He's quite young. He was only, 46 when he passed away, something like that. On November 30th, 1900, it was not, sort of one of those bright stars that we see sometimes. And he's an Irish poet and playwright. And his, but he was, he had a good leg up in life. His parents were both intelligent people. He was born and he spoke fluent French and German very early on, and in university he read something called Greats, and it's a name given to undergraduate course focused on classics at the University of Oxford and some other universities, and he just really loved it, and he was became recognized for his retention, his ability, and the way he put ideas together at Oxford. And then he became quite known in there was at the time this rising philosophy of aestheticism, and this was led by two of his tutors, Walter Pater and John Ruskin. But aestheticism, it's an intellectual and art movement supporting the emphasis of aesthetic values more than social political themes of literature and fine art and music and other art. And this meant that art from this particular movement focused more on being beautiful rather than having deeper meaning. And think of it as this idea of aestheticism washed over me. I thought this is more about a philosophy of the quality of life. And, you know, in being in that industrial heyday, the country that I live in, and in places where many of you are, you'll see remnants of the drive for practicality, where we had to make the most of the materials that we had at hand and that we were building. And that meant a lot of trial and error, things that did work and things that were time limited. The things that endured, we had no way of predicting. At the time, it's like today, we are very hopeful, and the upstarts are always hopeful that what they have is going to be permanent. But that notion of time has changed. It's now one of a notion that relates more to profit. The measure of success has changed. So when we're looking at, you know, the quality of life and the grime of our daily toil, some people, whether they're in the depths of the mines or walking the streets and breathing the essence, the remnants of industry, were asking the question: could there be something more? Or suggesting it more firmly, there has to be something more than this. Well, we see that audacious optimism around us all the time. And in balance, when we ask ourselves the bigger question about the direction that we're going in, we're soon going to be, about 2050, we're going to be 8 billion of us. It's quite a party on the face of the earth right now. We are asking these questions about sustainability. But when it's a bit more difficult and challenging to think of ourselves as contributing to that in our own way. It's odd. I think of the hummingbird wings that you have. The hummingbird wings that you have affecting climate. Well, does it? Well, yeah, it's an equation. It certainly does. But when the hurricane or the typhoon is barreling down on us, our movements through the atmosphere and the flutter, the effect in the air of the butterfly wings is insignificant. But it's perhaps better used as a metaphor. 8 billion of us have impact. So we need to be able to think about shifting how we go about doing things. And the only way we get there is by understanding that on a big scale. Well, not everybody can do this. You know, progress is a bit of a lumpy affair. It moves in fits and spurts, as I like to think of it. It's like masonry. It stumbles along like a three-year-old learning to walk. You know, sometimes you're moving too fast and you go to tumble, and hopefully there's a parent to grab you by the shirt and hold you up. And sometimes you tumble onto your you see children tumble onto their bellies, and they learn to keep their chin up and they just sort of bounce along and they pop back up because they have that ability, that flexibility, you know. We're in a bit like that. We have to be resilient, as we've learned over the years, and thick-skinned and watchful. So as we are learning the aesthetics of masonry, we learn not only that appreciation of what's going on around us and the curiosity for the quality of life. And it requires that we examine questions about, you know, the nature of happiness and things like that, satisfaction, success. It just gets better. So are we at the apex of the World Cup here in 2018? Yet? We soon will be. So for all of you who are around the world tuning in and cheering on your favorite team, I hope they all win. But I know my team well. To help us on our way, here's a little bit of Bud Powell just before we get into our commentary. This is called Bouncing with Bud, 1982. I think you like it. Bouncing with Bud. If you're not a fan or you haven't heard of his work, I think it's a great invitation to follow up a bit. Sit back a little bit. Give me your opinions, please. The commentary today is entitled "The Missing Masonic Art." Help me with this. Help me. You know how I sometimes stray away into the esoteric, I hope. What was in play prior to the Big Bang? You know, early in history, we were able to communicate by spoken word and symbols. Did those symbols morph into the stories and mysteries of artwork? Or was there a distinct school of Masonic art? And was that art designated by artist masons? If we thought that, we would be rewriting the meaning of art, and that would be disastrous. But if we examine this question, we will find a body of work that can be the lost corpus. Can we? Can it be the lost corpus of masonry? Art, in its various forms, tells us about civilizations and the people who inhabited the cities and countryside that made up the population. Were we to curate a show of Masonic art, I believe our understanding would greatly depend on how we looked at and thought about it. Music, the most ancient form, may be the most open secret display of Masonic art. How far back, we cannot say, but we do know musical accompaniment played an important role when Masons met. Instrumental and vocals added to the sense of solemnity and celebration, making Masonry very unique. One might be excused for thinking Masonry has parallels with a religious ceremony and would be unchallenged. When theocracy proved to be a harsh master, it taught us the value of separating spiritual guidance and church canon from civil law. For generations, this was a technicality that ran in the background. Fast forward to the 1970s, and we find an active press and politic running through organized religions. Shocking exposés of abuse by officials began the ethical tipping point for now on multiple generations. The music has faded in many ways in those churches, as it has for completely different reasons in Masonic lodges. McCoy Tyner, Impressions. Thank you. Impressions by McCoy Tyner. Here's some Oscar Wilde for you. This is his poem, Fabian de Prompt, to my friend Henry Irving. The silent room, the heavy creeping shade, the dead that travel fast, the opening door, the murdered brother rising through the floor, ghost's white fingers on my shoulders laid. And then the lonely duel in the glade, the broken swords, the stifled scream, the gore, the grand revengeful eyes when all is o'er. These things are well enough, but thou wert made for more august creation. Frenzied Lear should at thy bidding wander on the heath, with the shrill fool to mock him. Romeo, for thee, should lure his love and desperate fear, pluck Richard's creant dagger from its sheath, thou trumpet set for Shakespeare's lips to blow. Interesting mind, Interesting way this fellow is able to examine and share what he's seeing and thinking, looking with the mind's eye. A curious fellow. Oscar Wilde, he's worth a look. He wrote some plays. I'll just give you a short hint of them. And some books. The Counterful Ghost is one of my favorites. And Picture of Dorian Gray, that's been made into movies, of course. But it's the plays of Woman of No Importance and Ideal Husband, Lady Windermere's Fan, and The Importance of Being Earnest, Salome, the Duchess of Padua, Vera, or the Nihilist, and the Florentine Tragedy, Le Sante Cortisan. Busy man, busy fellow, eh? Busy, as you can imagine. So there you have it. That's Oscar Wilde for us for today. We have been listening and enjoying a review of symbolism. It gives us a chance to think back and to reflect on our lodge experience and what's been happening around us as we change. Nothing quite remains the same, including our own perspective on the world and on ourselves. It does change as we become older. And we have advantage and disadvantage, I guess, if you're looking at the broader scope of experience. We have as we age, as we mature, we experience regret and disappointment, as well as our successes, sense of successes and joys. We are able to examine insights into our own character. You know, when I was a boy, when we were boys, very few of us would have the capacity to examine Schadenfreude. You know, that wonderful composite words that the German culture has produced and helped us with. The Schadenfreude, it's a joy or satisfaction at the misfortune of others. And if you know the word, I thought was quite a revelation. And if you're mindful and you look around, we begin to see this happening where there is, whether it's in the marketplace or the media is playing up the misfortune of other people, it somehow penetrates. And we have to be, once we understand it, we can examine ourselves in that deeper pool of consciousness and awareness. How do we, and what does that say about us? So if we're enjoying the misfortune of somebody else, a mishap that happens to somebody else, maybe for me, I sanitize it and examine all of this on the sports field. When there's a good football game going on and there's that continuous struggle and competition back and forth where the teams are equally matched, as we're seeing going on in Russia right now. It seems to resolve some questions and fulfill some of those. Of course, I want my team, the team I'm cheering for, to win, and I want them to score. And it is enriched when I see the disappointment, because of that intense effort being made by the people defeated. And we know, well, of course, it is what it is. But nevertheless, it's life being played out in front of us if we look for it. Or it is the absolute joy, just the absolute joy of winning. And of course, we realize the teams that are there, each member of each team is not there because they can't do the job. They are excellent at what they do. They're the world's best. Woof. So we walk through our lodges, and we are often unable to contain the amount of information that is around us. And so, as you sit back and you relax, you can reflect with me on layers of understanding. Whether and how you put that together in your experience in masonry is singularly up to you, whether you do or whether you don't, whether you're conscious of it or unconscious of it. Whether you're, and I believe many of us are, whether you are curious as the nature of masonry changes, as the way that we adhere to the ancient landmarks becomes known to us, that deeper respect we have, it means we first understand the landmarks. And in the jurisdiction that I'm in, they are not articulated. And I think there is some merit in that, because the landmarks are already identified and defined in in our lineage. So we can confirm, but to outline our own, it seems in a way, unnecessary. It's like taking the second obligation. If you've taken an obligation for the three degrees, what what more, you know, do you need 10? Do you need 11? But boys will be competitive, and so we need to, for some, it's collecting the experience. So the more experiences you have, the more check marks you have beside your name, the better the Mason? Or is it the study, the entered apprentice, that is what we seek? Somewhere in between, I think, is where the that fulcrum is. What helps us to define our self in relation to Masonry and Masonry in relation to us is on a symbolic level. I hope, as you can see here, we're in a very small way. Masonic Effects honors music and the arts through the airwaves. Poetry, we could do more, I suspect. Poetry and music. A homage, a reflection, where we truly sit and listen to, you know, expressions and interpretations of our environment that artists have, that talented people have pulled. It's like pulling the sculpture out of the marble block. Here, let's look at something that's being pulled out, the pillars or the columns, as we like to think of them. This, it's not an apology, it's an acknowledgement that this work largely was formed and the filigree was developed around Britain. Not the only one, but we have the advantage that it's an enriched field of study, because in part there were great minds behind it, and as we sit now, it's not that we are a shell of our former selves. We don't have the appeal to the mind of a Christopher Wren or the Ashmole or Darwin. We don't have those, but we have it in a different way. We have it in a different way. We think that we move forward sociologically. You and I have access to things that were only available to the privileged of the day. And now it's not humbler, it's a nobler expression of how important the arts are in the experience of life. They're so important that we have sought it out, and that it's important, the quality of life and the quality of our experience is important enough that we've joined an order that helps us without ever telling us, because to tell us would mean in some ways it would have to be enforced. And the world that we're operating in now is unenforceable. It's that internal justification, that internal recognition that is essential. We're men and women of conscience. Yes, men and women. So to the seventh chapter of the Book of Kings talks a bit about pillars, doesn't it? Nice. This is a nice little bit of lineage. For he cast two pillars of brass of 18 cubits high apiece, and a line of 12 cubits did compass either of them about. So that 12 cubits around. He made two chapiters of molten brass to set upon the tops of the pillars. And the height of one chapiter was 5 cubits, and the height of the other was 5 cubits, in nets of checker work and wreaths of chain work. For the chapiters were upon the tops of the pillars, 7 for the one chapiter and 7 for the other. And he made the pillars and two rows round them upon the one network to cover the chapiters that were upon the top with pomegranates. And so did he for the other chapiter. And the chapiters that were upon the top of the pillars were of lily work of the porch, 4 cubits, and the chapiters upon the two pillars had pomegranates above them, over against the belly, which was by the network. And the pomegranates were 200 in rows, round about upon the other chapiter. And he set up the pillars in the porch of the temple, and he set up the right pillar and called the name thereof. And he set up the left pillar and called the name thereof. You're all familiar with the names. And upon the top of the pillars was lily work. So was the work of the pillars finished. And this was taken from the Authorized Version of the Bible, current in the 17th and 18th century and most of the 19th century. The description of the pillars is also given in the 2 Chronicles chapter 3. This description is much shorter and slightly different in the dimensions, given that it what was assumed to be the combined height of the two pillars as 35 cubits or 17 and a half each. This description is the basis on which more modern workings operate, and it appears in most older illustrations and lectures. One of the old lectures explains the discrepancy in height between the two descriptions by stating that the pillars were made 18 cubits each, but half a cubit was sunk in the earth so that they only stood at 17 and a half. As Masons adopted the temple as the symbolic emblem of the lodge, it was natural that these pillars should find themselves a place in Masonic ritual and symbolism. There has always been difference of opinion as to what is right or left in connection with them. The reference to Ezekiel chapter 8, already mentioned, is taken as some authority by saying that the porch and entrance of the temple was at the east end. A passage from Winston's translation of Josephus' Antiquities of the Jews, published in 1735, is quoted in one of the old lectures and shows that the Masons of the 18th century had no doubts on the question of left or right pillars. The Hebrews expressed the east by before, the west by behind, the north by the left hand, and the south by the right, according to the position of a man who has his face to the rising sun. So although we have changed the orientation of our lodges, most ritual workings consider the left and right pillars as if looking out, as this description seems to imply. Ah, William Leslie Wilmshurst explains that the literal translation of Jachin, which he states to be an abbreviation of Jehoiakim, is God establishes, and that Boaz biblically translated means strength or energy. He suggests that symbolically the left-hand pillar represents the spirit and the right hand the body, or matter, so that the combination of the two represents the complete man, neither pillar being complete without the other. He also stresses the use made in our language of such expressions as pillars of society and suggests that Masons can find a moral. William Hutchison in The Spirit of Masonry, published in 1775, saw something also in the translation from the Hebrew of the names of the pillars. The pillars erected at the porch of the temple were not only ornamental, but also carried with them an emblematical importance of their name. Boaz being in its literal translation, in thee is strength, and Jachin is in shall be established, which by a very natural transposition may be put thus. O Lord, thou art almighty, and thy power is established from everlasting to everlasting. So may the Lord establish the throne of David and his kingdom for his seed forever, and the strength of the Lord shall be the king rejoice. You're thinking. Now, do we tend to think as firmly as our 18th century brethren. Mm-hmm. 18th century, no doubts in the question, left or right. So the Hebrews express the East by before and the West by behind. The North by the left and the South by the right. As if according to the position of a man who is facing the sun, the rising sun. So the debate goes on. Are we looking out? Are we looking in? And so, and even when we see many tracing boards, we see a representation of that expressed. So, east before, west behind. Clever, eh? Don't you love it? Jean-Luc Ponty, you're going to love this too. It's from 1982. A little reflection. Right now, the Montreal Jazz Festival is going on. I think it's 36th in reincarnation. Wonderful. And so the largest jazz festival in the world right now, if that matters to you. This is from Jean-Luc Ponty. I was very much a fan of his work back in the 70s. And see what you think. This is a live, practice live performance in Montreal. Thank you. Jean-Luc Ponty, Mirage. As you can tell, there are different aspects of jazz, just as there are different aspects of masonry. So the appropriate music for Masonic effects, I think. We approximate things. Let's face it. We are not the builders of the great cathedrals. We are not. We are the students of the architecture and engineering. We are, in our own ways, participants in a complex world. We are communicators. Masonry, at least in my mind, was one of the first forms of social media. First form of media would have been expression. Before we had language, we would have had the capacity for art, to be able to make our markings or our shapes, our representations on the surfaces around us. And we see that in some of the cave paintings that have existed for a couple of thousand years. No, we're not enduring. The dinosaurs were around for about 350 million years. They've been extinct for 96 million years. We have not been around nearly that long. You think about the remains of our ancients that are being found. Are we looking at hundreds of thousands of years? And so this is to be enjoyed for what it is. Our time here is brief. We may see the ancient remnants, so the remnants of the ancient dinosaurs and the birds that fly around. What will be the remnant of us in the future, do you think? There will be a remnant. So we're evolving, and so is our environment. I have to draw a source to authenticate some of this opinion, if you don't mind. I would apologize for that. I don't mean to be derivative, but it's just to authenticate the notion that we are not in reenactment, although I put that question to you. We're not a reenactment of what was going on. And as it's been nicely captured in Will Hurst's work, so far as we go, our rituals and doctrine are an authentic embodiment of a secret doctrine and a secret process that has always existed for the enlightenment of such aspirants as putting their trust in God. And that's, as our present candidates are made to say, have knocked at the door of certain secret sanctuaries in the confidence that the door would be open. And they would find in due course that for which they were seeking. But those who instituted modern speculative masonry, some remember his period of time, 250 years ago, now 300, took certain materials lying readily at hand. They took, that is, the elementary rites and symbols pertaining to medieval operative guilds of stonemasons and transformed them into a system of religio-philosophic doctrine. Thenceforth, from being related to the trade which deals in stones and bricks, the intention of masonry was to deal solely and simply with the greater science of soul building, and save for retaining certain analogies which the art of the practical stonemason provided. Thenceforth, it became dedicated to purposes that are wholly spiritual, religious, and philosophic. Perhaps the evidence of the transformation thus effected was the incorporation of the central legend and traditional history comprised in our third degree. Obviously, that legend can have had no relation to or practical bearing upon the operative builder's trade. I will ask you to reflect that no building of stone, nor temple, or edifice capable of being built with hands has remained unfinished through the death of any professional architect, such as Hiram Sabiff is popularly supposed to have been. The principles of architecture, the genuine secrets of the building trade, are not and never have been lost. They are thoroughly well known, and the absurdity is manifest of supposing that masons of any kind are waiting for time or circumstances to restore any lost knowledge or as to the manner in which temporal buildings ought to be constructed. We know how to erect buildings today quite as well as our Hebrew forefathers who built the famous temples in Jerusalem. And indeed, a well-known architect has stated that most of the London churches are, both for size and ornamentation, far larger and more splendid than that temple ever was. Our duty, then, is to look behind the literal story, to pierce the veil of allegory contained in the great legend, and to grasp the significance of its true purport. That which is lost is to be found, we are told, with the center. But if we inquire what a center is, the average mason will give you nothing more than the official, enigmatic, and not very luminous answer, that it is a point within a circle from which every part of the circumference is equidistant. But what circle and what circumference? There's no such thing as centers or circles in respect to ordinary buildings or architecture. And here the average mason is at an utter loss to explain. Press him further. Why with the center? And again, we could only give you the elusive and perplexing answer, because that is a point from which a master mason cannot err, and you are no wiser. Brethren, it is just this elusiveness, that intentional enigmas, this proposed puzzle language, that are intended to put us on the scent of something deeper that the words themselves convey. And if we fail to find, to realize, to act upon the intention of what is veiled behind the letter of the rituals, we can scarcely claim to understand our own doctrine. We can scarcely claim to have been regularly initiated, passed and raised in the higher sense of these expressions. Whatever ceremonies we have formally passed through, the letter killeth the spirit and giveth life. Let us inquire what the spirit of this puzzle language is. The method of all great religious and initiatory systems has been to teach their doctrine in the form of myth, legend, or allegory. As our first tracing board lecture says, the philosophers, unwilling to expose their mysteries to vulgar eyes, conceal their tenets and principles of philosophy under hieroglyphical figures. And our traditional history is one of these hieroglyphical figures. Now, the literally minded never see behind the letter of the allegory. The truly initiated mind discerns the allegory's spiritual nature. In fact, part of the purpose of all initiation was, and still is, to educate the mind in penetrating the outward shell of all phenomena. And the value of initiation depends upon the way in which the inward truths are allowed to influence our thought and lives, and to awaken us still deeper powers of consciousness. The legend of the third degree, then, in which the essence of Masonic doctrine lies, was brought into our system by some advanced minds who derived their knowledge from other and concealed sources. The legend is an adaptation of a very old one and existed in various forms long before its association with modern masonry. In the guise of a story about the building of a temple by King Solomon at Jerusalem, they were promulgating the truth which I have alluded to before and which is generally known as the fall of man. As our legend runs, upon the literal side of it, it was the purpose of a great king to erect a superb structure. He was assisted in that work by another king who supplied the building materials, by a skillful artificer whose business it was to put these together according to a preordained plan, and by large companies of craftsmen and labor. But in the course of the work, an evil conspiracy arose, resulting in the destruction of the chief artificer and preventing the completion of the building, which remains, therefore, unfinished to this day. You look beyond the veil. You look beyond what's going on outwardly to what's going on metaphorically to the enigma. As the writer, as Wilmhurst is explaining to us, this is part of every initiatory process, including us. Well, as I look at we're talking about the Mind Palace. I have to leave you again this week. I am thankful and grateful that you've taken the time to join us. We need to be able to move forward with our studies, with our understanding and appreciation, if we so choose. So is and you know, as I sit here thinking, you know, it's an enjoyable day, and I can't suggest that everybody is in this frame of mind. We approach Masonry with a sense of mindfulness. Wherever we are in the face of the earth, we take that moment to reflect, to absorb. There is much to learn, just as there is much going through your mind in any given day. But approach your life and approach the sense with a sense of purpose and meaning, mindfully, being aware as you are, truthfully, you are a Freemason. An acknowledgement to Lady Freemasons. So glad to see the embracing the landmarks and moving on. And to all of you committing those acts of random Masonic kindness, I am humbled. Thank you for joining us this week. Hope you've enjoyed. Tell your friends. Tell your friends about Masonic Effects, and know that you are part of a rare and unconventional group, and perhaps even among the initiated. You're taking some time to reflect on yourself. You know, as boys, we were never ever taught to take time to reflect upon ourselves. I'll leave you with Dizzy Gillespie's Manteca. This is from 1982, from the Lincoln Center. What's not to like? Thank you.
Thank you.